You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, October 29th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, a special 2016 Republican primary debate review with Cliff Schechter on a Thursday instead of a Friday, ladies and gentlemen. Also on the program today, just hours before the Republican debate, we had a pretty sizable budget deal. And Bernie Sanders on the campaign trail makes an announcement as to a major policy position on the legal status of marijuana. And just moments ago, ladies and gentlemen, Paul Ryan, elected Speaker of the House. All that and more on today's program. In fact, no, not more. Just that. Probably going to do an abbreviated program today, or perhaps no member show today, because we're all fried. We did two shows yesterday. Did about 4 or 5 hours of radio yesterday, and we are still also dealing with our operations and whatnot. I just got an IM. Please tell me this is a bonus Cliff Schechter and not just an early Cliff Schechter. Well, it's a bonus, but it's also early. So you will enjoy that. And we will be back tomorrow. But, you know, once you get close to Halloween, we have never had a good record in this office, or not just this office, but in any office that we've been in doing the program, or studio, I should say, of getting a show off on Halloween. We very often have problems, so one never knows. Let me just read this. We got an interesting email yesterday from Scott in Stockholm, Sweden. I don't know if people realize this, but we have listeners all across the globe. This is actually probably a good excuse for me to sort of just give you an idea of just how wide this program's reaches. Now, of course, it's the internets, and so that's not what's that? It's the internets, but so that's not, you know, let's not pat ourselves on the backs too much. I mean, there's a certain inevitability, right? I mean, when you're going to, but let me see what we got here. We've got people all across the globe listening to this program.
South Africa.
Yes. Just to the top 10, U.S., Canada, United Kingdom, Australia, Japan, Germany, other regions. I don't know where that is. Sweden, France, and Norway. The Republic of Korea, China, Taiwan, United Arab Emirates,
Nice.
South Africa, as you say.
Allahu Akbar, United Arab Emirates.
Saudi Arabia. Singapore. Turkey. Costa Rica. The Russian Federation. Czech Republic. Hungary. Belize. Panama. Greece. Chile. Kenya.
Israel. Why don't you ever mention us?
Did I pass over Israel? Maybe we lost
all
our
listeners.
What a
surprise. He skips right over the only time you mention
Macau, Vietnam. I'm just hitting, Egypt, Guam, Estonia, Ghana, Ethiopia, Jamaica, Serbia, Tunisia, Myanmar, Tanzania. Wow. It's just Senegal. I'm just picking out Lebanon, Lithuania. I could keep going on. Swaziland. Turks and Caicos, Laos, Albania,
Trinidad?
Libya, Libyan Arab Jamhuriya. It goes on and on. Bangladesh.
Really do have some members of ISIS that listen to this show.
It's impossible. Connecticut. All right. So this is...
And the nutmeg state.
And the nutmeg state. First, Scott from Stockholm, Sweden writes, I am a member and proud of it. Yours is my favorite political program. I would give you a blast of the shofar, but I think we are shofarless today. Well, not just shofarless. We're sound. We're sound deficit today. In your most recent podcast, you mentioned that we members don't have to listen to the ads. I thank you for that, truly. May I never have to hear another in what remains of my life. But then I got to thinking. If others are like me, and from what trickles through listeners' feedback, there must be a large unmet desire to never have to hear that dreadful La Poupée non-non-non-songoid. I honestly believe if you announced and followed through that members get to escape that insidious earworm, as bad or worse than the Barney the Dino song or Disney's It's a Small World After All, a sizable number of people would take the plunge. Shall we test that thesis?
Oh, I definitely. Right. I have a lot of compassion for people that don't like that song because I am certainly one of them.
Are you? I didn't know that.
I don't know if it's an earworm, but I get why people don't want to hear it all the time.
I'm not completely beyond comprehending why people that bothers people. Here is the challenge I will make to you folks right now. If we get 10 new members by Monday, 10 new members at jointhemajorityreport.com. Actually, let's make it by Sunday night. All right. So don't be lazy about this. You should really just do it immediately. If we get 10 new members, we will cut out La Poupée for members. You will not have to listen to it. I will dip in. I will say, I'm going out. The music will rise and then just go. You know, we can't totally eliminate it because I talk over it. But we'll swing it back down very quickly. And it'll be like a 10-second or just 5 seconds after I talk. Right? We can do that. Right, Matt? Right, new Matt?
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
Me, Matt.
Me, Matt. Because we had old Matt last night, or people say classic Matt, was in last night. And so new Matt was here, but he's like, me, Matt? Yes, you, Matt.
Me, Matt drinks beer.
Yeah.
Not just Monster Energy drink. Me, Matt, man. Me, Matt.
So that's what it'll be. 10 new members. We will cut out the La Poupée song.
Wait, I have a quick question about this.
Okay.
If someone, say, they upgrade, they become a Cedarista, as an example, what does that count against the new members? How are we going to do that? See what I'm saying?
I understand the question. The question is, if someone goes from a majority reporter to a Burundi, incidentally, Palau, we have almost every place they've ever done a survivor.
I thought Burundi was a new membership level.
No. Burundi, yeah.
I like that.
yes, I will. If we get an upgrade or two or 10, I don't know. We will count an upgrade. If you go from majority reporter to Cedarista, because, you know, we shouldn't punish you if you're a member not to have a vote in this. We will also cut the song out. And if there's a member out there who feels really strongly about leaving it in, maybe we'll create a new membership level, like a La Poupée level. which would be so much money that you subject the rest of us. We will put in, or we will just give you a specific stream every day.
Oh, wow.
It's going to be a pretty high membership.
I hope Matt gets a real bonus for that.
Yeah, I better get a cut of that.
All right. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Cliff Schechter. We are back, ladies and gentlemen. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. Listeners of this show will know that on Fridays we have Cliff Schechter come on to give us a review of the new, the week in the new in the news, or the news in the week, a review. But we are doing a special version of Cliff Schechter to wrap up last night's Republican debate, and to also probably wrap up the week, because, you know, we always have those problems with Halloween, where it's very tough for us to get the show off. We always run into some technical difficulties.
Bizarre.
But what I can say is that we do not have such great technical difficulties, or we're not anticipating such, that we can't play the theme song that plays on every other Friday.
Cliff Schechter, Libertas LLC. New media, public relations, and strategy. You want any of these services, you know who you gotta see. Cliff Schechter, Libertas LLC.
Now, Cliff, you probably could not hear that, your theme song.
I could not.
Okay, that's okay. We would live and learn here. It's not that big of a deal. You know what was happening.
You promise you played it? You're not just screwing with me?
We may not even be on air. How's that?
I'm not even sure I'm really here right now.
No,
where I think I am.
You are here, Cliff, and we did, in fact, play the theme song. It is always a pleasure to talk to you. I presume, maybe I'm being a little presumptuous because I know you grew up in New York. I don't know if I've ever asked you this, if you are a Yankees or a Mets fan. People don't realize outside of New York that it's rare you find someone who is both. And so
that is true. I am not that rarity. I thought you and I had a Yankees Boston throwdown.
Okay, yeah, I imagine you were a Yankees fan.
I'm not sure how you mean that, Sam. I'm sure in a nice way. I'm sure. No, I get to claim non bandwagon status with the Yankees because my dad grew up in the Bronx, a couple blocks from the stadium, and used to run out to try to get Joe DiMaggio's autograph and all that stuff. So I'm legit. And the way I try to make sure people understand I'm a legit Yankees fan is to tell them that I'm a Knicks fan too. And nobody in their right mind would be a Knicks fan.
No.
So that one was as much a punishment for my family as being a Yankees fan was a gift.
Yeah, I guess, you're not going to get it's not like being a Boston fan where it's, we've had times where it was just all four seasons. You know what I mean? Celts, Pats, Bruins, Sox.
On any given Knicks season, you sort of have to take a bet at the beginning what the chances, and you'd be smart to bet that there more likely will be a sexual harassment suit against a member of management than there will be a chance to make the playoffs.
The Pats through that period back in the day, the Victor Kiam years, but we don't need to talk about that. Because I ask if you were a Mets fan, because were you one of those people who watched the World Series or watched the debate last night? I hope it's the debate because we're going to do a wrap-up of it right now.
Oh, I thought we were wrapping up the World Series.
Well, ladies and gentlemen,
now I watched the debate. As painful as it was, sometimes my job, I mean, I still would have watched the World Series if I could have, because I am a fan of baseball in general, but this is important to the work I do. So why should I have to suffer it less than anybody else who does this work?
I got to say, I enjoy watching these debates. I have fun. We sit around here with some beers and some pizza, and I get to play with all my conservative icon dolls to set up the video camera. So I have immense pleasure in it. The one that I find really tiresome is the kids table debate. I barely watched that thing.
I didn't watch it at all, I gotta be honest.
Let me tell you what you missed.
I couldn't, but nothing. I'll say quickly, just to sort of agree with you, I'd say the first kind of half hour to 45 minutes, I actually enjoy it. But when it starts becoming really repetitive and they all start making these big, bold, I say that with quotes around it, statements like they're saying something huge, you know, that's just the dumbest thing that makes no sense. I just, you know, after a while of seeing Chris Christie stare at the camera, I felt like I was like a pork chop he was about to bite. You know, there's just a point where I lose my, you know, it starts becoming like, okay, I've heard Carly make up things again. But you're right. The first period of time, it is pretty funny because, you know, they're them.
All right. I want to dispose of two things. One is that the viewership last night was only 10 million. It was 25 million for the first Republican debate. I believe it was 20 million for the CNN debate. Last night was only 10, which is even worse news for CNBC. In my understanding, they promised people 15 million on their ad buys. And so they're...
There's going to be some people asking for some money back.
Exactly.
In the marketing departments.
Exactly. And there's a lot of like, can I interest you in some swag conversations?
Well, before we get to even the debate, Sam, can I bring up one important thing?
Yes.
As somebody who has virtually never watched CNBC before, I think I was on that channel. Like Donnie Deutsch used to have a show on there. I think I went on that show like two or three times, but I didn't even watch it when I went on it. I just went in for my little camera thing and left. Wow. I mean, I found myself longing for Fox News.
Yes.
They're just as dumb and just as right wing without the good graphics. So it was like a right wing Wayne's World. I felt like we're watching public access lunatics. I mean, the sets are terrible. The graphics are terrible. The personalities didn't know anything. I mean, the people on there, at least on Fox News, they're people that like know enough to say the wrong stuff and actually sound convincing.
There was a moment during the debate where the CNBC moderator, one of the 14 that apparently they brought in,
they just kept cycling them in and out. It was hysterical.
Yeah, it was literally like everybody, you know, it was like an elementary school t-ball game where the coach said, "Okay, everybody's going to get a chance to hit." And
I'll say one thing: like, oh my God! I mean, I'd never seen except for that one rant that went viral with the whole, in which they give the credit for the burgeoning Tea Party movement, Santelli.
Right.
I mean, if that guy isn't the biggest fucking moron.
Oh.
I mean that he's actually allowed on like a station that's supposed to be like legitimate to say things is amazing to me. He looked like he was a meth addict.
Yeah, it was very strange. It was very, very strange. But the other moderator who basically accused Trump of saying something, and it turned out he ultimately did, but you go and you challenge Trump with a question. You said, and I quote, blah, 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 and Trump says, I never said that. And instead of saying, well, I have it right here, it is from this story in the Washington Post or blah, 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 she says, well, then where did I hear it? I'm sorry, you're a journalist. You're
right.
Not coming
you know,
with
you're
citations.
You're supposed to have these things called sources
in
front of you.
Was, I mean, come on. It's not like you
I mean,
just
and
like.
Jim Cramer comes up. I mean, there's not bells and whistles going off and him, you know, farting noises or whatever the hell he does in his stupid.
Oh.
I mean, these people are such fucking. I'm sorry, I keep cursing. These people are such clowns. And I mean, it was just amazing to me. Amazing.
All right, let's get into the substance of it. I mean, I'm going to briefly dispose of the kids table debate by saying there was Bobby Jindal, George Pataki, and Rick Santorum and Lindsey Graham. The only interesting things came out of that.
It's Pataki, getting cozy.
Pataki admitted that Obama inherited a disastrous economy, which if the Democrats were smart, they would be talking about that.
Constantly.
Because Pataki is not.
Because you keep hearing it, like I saw in some of the pre-interviews and post-interviews. And, of course, there's this one guy that was like classic white guy with helmet head, you know, who was basically could fit in Fox as a Republican who was on the air there. And, like, he just, you know, he was trying to help them out. We were like, yeah, but I know the unemployment is low, but how about all the people in the labor market who have given up,
right,
you know, and all this sort of stuff like that, because nobody gave up during the Bush years from applying for jobs because things were so bad. And so, I mean, like, you know, there was always a reason why, even though most of the indicators have improved, and yeah, the few that haven't are due to the people that are actually debating there. Like, you know, hearing Rick Santorum say, well, wages have flatlined. Well, I wonder why that is, Rick. Let's talk about your political philosophy and how that's completely contributed to that factor.
Indeed. And then the other upshot of the little kids table was that Lindsey Graham answered every question. He did not specifically call for boots on the ground and a ground invasion of any country, but he did say in response to every single question, he did bring up ISIS. That includes things
what
like
do you think
Medicare.
About abortion rights,
and,
Lindsey Graham?
Honestly.
Well, I think ISIS hates abortion, and I hate them in most ways. That one issue, I could see him just working ISIS into everything. That man must have very bad nightmares.
Well, he was trumpeted as the winner, basically, of that debate by CNBC, basically because he was the only one who really said crazy enough things to actually keep anybody awake during that. All right, so let's talk about the big debate. Let's start from the bottom up, right? Huckabee, we don't even have to really talk about, because Mike Huckabee, we know this is really it's quite clear. The only relevance
he's running for speaking fees.
Exactly. I mean, Huckabee. In fact,
he went from no-name governor who had literally, there's an article in Salon, you should go Google it, I can't remember who wrote it, about how he stole the furniture out of the governor's mansion. I think we've discussed this before, and had to actually then eventually either bring some of it back or pay for it. Like, that's how, when they say about somebody, you know, they'll take anything that's not nailed down, that's actually true about Mike Huckabee. So this guy was looking to make a quick buck, as any fake faux preacher that he is would, and I mean, it worked out amazingly for him last time, because he was a nobody, right? He was a governor of a small state and nobody knew who he was. Suddenly he was doing, you know, he was coming through town every year with best-selling books. He was going to all the gravy train speaking gigs. I mean, you know, he found a way to make money.
And we should say, you know, he actually tried to work this in, it seemed to me, on two different questions about chronic diseases and diabetes. And my guess is that he did that on purpose, because that's going to be a clip when he goes out and sells some of his whatever it's going to be, whatever woo he's going to be
awesome,
pitching.
Right? The yeah. biblical cure, like his biblical cure to cancer he sold, it'll now be like the biblical cure.
Well, he's talking about diabetes. I mean, he was a big cinnamon salesman for diabetes.
Yep.
And so... He was pushing that. He also had one line where he alluded to Vince Foster. I think at that time it actually caused Michael in the Bill Clinton voice to drag the body to the park. But here's the only relevant thing about this is that he is going to stay in. I would imagine, I haven't seen his financials, but I imagine he's spending virtually no money on this campaign. He's not worried about that. He'll stay in there.
I guess this is not even a real campaign. They have just like one advisor who makes almost nothing in one of those deals.
So he's going to stay in there and lob these grenades from time to time. And you've also got Rand Paul.
Well, he just needs to last to South Carolina, and he'll probably, you know, at least get a decent amount there, because he's got name recognition and he's a Southern preacher, and then he can at least hang around until Super Tuesday. And again, every week he hangs around, you could probably guess speaking fees go up with a couple $1,000s.
Yep. Rand Paul, I gotta think that he is going to get out either in the next week or the day before the debate on November 10th. I don't think he shows up for that debate on November 10th.
He's getting a lot of pressure, too, I can tell you, from the home, his home turf. McConnell and the people that lead the Kentucky Republican Party are saying to him, get out. because you can't, I mean, we cannot risk losing this seat with you not paying any attention to it. And his numbers have plummeted because of that in Kentucky. And so they, you know, I think the combination of how he's doing and all that pressure at home, especially if, you know, there's a contested governor's race, they have an off year race, you know, and they've got a Tea Party nut who they nominated, they pulled a Missouri and, you know, whatever, nominated the guy who's a lunatic and not the more reasonable presenting, as we've discussed, not that their positions are different. And we've got, you know, probably one of the most well-known Pauls in Kentucky, and Jack Conway, who's the attorney general. And if Conway, it's a very close race right now. I mean, if this guy had been the nominee in a more moderate state, this thing would be over. But because it's Kentucky, he still has a shot to win, but it looks like Conway could win. And if the Democrats win again after holding that governor's mansion for two terms, you'll see, then I think the calls will grow even more because people are going to blame Rand Paul and say, you know, tend to your home.
Right.
You know.
Rand Paul seems so just upset that it wouldn't surprise me if he just decided, like, I'm done with this. Like, he just he quit the Senate.
I wouldn't be surprised either, because I think he always kind of ran to be his dad and get to run for president, maybe, you know, thinking he could improve upon what his dad had done and win. I could see him just walking away, too, and then going maybe pulling, like, what the hell's his name? He went to the Heritage Foundation.
Right.
Dements. He could just go lead some big, you know, probably instead of right wing, go lead some crazy, you know, pseudo libertarian, more, you know, neo Confederate organization and rake in some bucks that way. I could totally see him doing it much easier. Right. Don't have to do very much.
Right.
And the Senate actually.
Nobody makes fun of him anymore. I mean,
right, the Senate to a guy like him actually limits his earning potential.
Yeah.
I mean, he can go to those places and make 10 times what he makes in the Senate. So.
It's very
more.
Possible. So I'd be surprised if he hangs around for much longer. So, and then let's just talk about Chris Christie. Chris Christie getting high marks, as he always does, from the mainstream pundits. And frankly, I think he's going to see exactly zero bump from this.
I think it just allows him to hang around.
Yep.
He had, I would say, one or two decent moments. They weren't even great. I mean, you have to think about it. And I'm thinking about it. I'm trying to put myself in the addled mindset of a Republican primary voter. So that whole, why are we talking about the NFL? Blah, blah, blah. You know, that played very well with them. As did. So to me, Christie did just enough to stay in it. Whereas Huckabee, as you said, you know, would be gone if it weren't for what he's doing. I felt like Rand Paul and, surprisingly, John Kasich and Jeb Bush all did enough, just enough, and basically did not enough to stay in it. And I'm really interested to see what happens. I mean, Jeb has the money.
Well, let's talk about Kasich. Let's talk about Kasich before we get to Jeb Bush. Because Kasich just the other day had sort of gone off. I'm so sick of what's going on in this party, blah, blah, blah. And there was a big talk about him coming in strong. He started out that way. And basically he said, these guys are jokers here. Carson and Trump are jokers. And then Trump shut him down. And I think, you know, Kasich is
that was a key moment because Trump just completely parried what he said and just shut him up and made him look small in comparison. The whole year at the end of the thing and his numbers have been shrinking. I mean, his national numbers never went that high, but he did what I thought was very smart, which is he made a strategic investment in putting and going on the air in New Hampshire. So his numbers came up. He got more respect from that from the mainstream media. They started saying maybe this guy could be the alternative to Jeb. But he never followed that up with anything. From what I hear, he hasn't really been spending. He's still lazy, I guess. I don't know what it is, but he doesn't really have a staff in New Hampshire. Hasn't been spending a ton of time there. I mean, this is a guy that needs a McCain-type strategy or something like that. He's not going to do well in Iowa. He needs to put all his chips in New Hampshire and basically live there. And he hasn't done it.
Harder to do as a governor, I think, if you want to maintain some popularity in your state. Because you look at other governors who have done that. Chris Christie had tried to do that, and the guy's now, you know, a basement dweller in his own state. And so
that is true, and that might hurt his general election argument. I get what you're saying, but it's almost like that's something to worry about later.
Yep.
Whereas if you don't, you know, at least come in second or third in New Hampshire, you're done. I mean, you never get to later, and he hasn't put in the time and the energy and effort, it seems to me, to follow up on that. And his debate performances, I mean, he's actually not. I mean, as these guys go, he's pretty decent on TV, but he never seems to have a moment. He never seems to have a good, you know, series. I mean, some of the stuff he said the other day, you're right, and I expected him to come in, but then he sort of wimped away from it. Like, he wouldn't name names. He wouldn't. I mean, for him to have a good moment, he needed to challenge those guys directly. And then you know that
but the
that,
problem is,
you know, Ben Carson won't react because he's asleep, but maybe Trump reacts like he did, and you've got to win that argument.
And fundamentally, the problem he has too is that his brand of Republicanism, I'm sorry, it's just he, you know, has broken with the conservative orthodoxy. I mean, the
he's the huntsman of this.
I think so. Yeah. And I would be surprised if he sticks around much longer, because where do you go?
I think he and Rand are both done.
Where do you go after you say, like, I'm sick of this? This is crazy. What's going on here? What's your next act after that? Well, it's
right.
Crazy,
I mean,
but, you know, so.
Right, and he's not going to get the right-wing speaking fee tour, but he'll get plenty of corporate invitations. As,
yep.
as Donald Trump made sure to mention, he was at Lehman Brothers.
That was he's devastating.
He's in with the Wall Street guys. He's, you know, he's got all that going on. He could get a show again on Fox like he had in
yep.
between Congress. And so he doesn't need, you know, if this is the end of his political career, if it's as high as he's getting as governor, he doesn't need to stick around. And if somebody's going to consider him for some sort of a cabinet post, which is unlikely because he's got a big mouth and doesn't sort of, you know, bow
right.
down to others, he's not loyal. So I wouldn't be surprised if he pulled a Sarah Palin. I think he always ran for governor here in the hope of being able to run for president again, like he did in 2000. That was always his ambition. So let's see. Let's see how that plays out.
Okay. So that takes us to Jeb, Rubio, Cruz, Carson, and Trump is left here, okay, and Fiorina. And
yep.
So with these six that I just mentioned, let's start with this framework. There are two different primaries that are going on simultaneously. There is
yeah.
the primary where you are looking to get electoral advantage. You're looking to have support that shows up in polls from Republican primary voters. The second parallel primary is you are looking to the big donors, establishment and otherwise, and you're saying, I am the most viable candidate for the long term. I may not be up in the polls, or I may be up in the polls. That doesn't matter. I have the real bona fides to take this all the way to the convention and to win and to possibly win in the general election. So let's talk about the latter first. Which is that, and that primary is essentially going on between Rubio and Bush at the moment. I think Cruz is sort of in there too, but he's sort of hanging back. So it's Rubio and Bush, and that primary, I think, more or less ended last night.
Yeah, I mean, maybe Bush, you know, he already has cut everybody's salaries. He's already had the meeting with the family, you know, to discuss it all. In the end, you know, he's Fredo. He got passed over when George W. got put in, and now his protege Rubio has also. It must be doubly painful. He's not good on a stage. He's not quick on his feet. He's kind of a boring guy. His answers are terrible. And you know, so for him, the only way you're going to make it as sort of a center-right, not crazy person and be able to get the nomination at this point when we've gotten here. Romney and McCain did, but that's because of a combination of the far right hadn't become as powerful. They kept getting more powerful. And also, you had a situation where a lot of the people who were involved in those primaries were just such lunatics that even Republicans couldn't stick with them for longer than a week. Whereas now I think they would, but so you've gotten to a point now where Bush would need the kind of charisma that would allow him to be a center right guy and still have the far right go for him. I think Rubio has that.
Well, okay,
Bush does not.
Let me,
it's just not going to happen.
Okay, all right. So here is why: when we talk about the primary that's involved with donors, with big establishment donors who are giving money, here is why we say Jeb Bush lost last night. It was this exchange where he went head to head with Rubio. And frankly, I think that Jeb Bush had already been beaten to a pulp by Donald Trump. And this was his last attempt, essentially, to convince these establishment donors that I can vanquish all the other people I'm competing with for your checkbook. And that guy, that primary guy, was Marco Rubio. And here's the exchange where Marco Rubio basically vanquished Jeb Bush. And let me tell you something. If Marco Rubio can own you in a debate, you've got some real problems. Here's that exchange.
In 2008, Barack Obama missed 60 or 70% of his votes, and the same newspaper endorsed him again. So this is another example of the double standard that exists in this country between the mainstream media and the conservative media.
All right, pause it for a second. So Marco Rubio has just been asked right here, you haven't shown up for any votes. Why is that? You know, and Rubio responds to the moderator, and then this happens.
Can I bring something up here?
Here's
because
Jeb.
I'm a constituent of the senator, and I helped him, and I expected that he would do constituent service, which means that he shows up to work. He got endorsed by the Sun Sentinel because he was the most talented guy in the field. He's a gifted politician. But Marco, when you signed up for this, this was a six-year term, and you should be showing up to work. I mean, literally, the Senate, what is it, like a French work week? You get like 3 days where you have to show up? You can campaign or just resign and let someone else take the job. There are a lot of people living paycheck to paycheck in Florida as well. They're looking for a senator that will fight for them each and every day.
I get to respond, right?
30 seconds.
30 seconds. Well, it's interesting. Over the last few weeks, I've listened to Jeb as he walked around the country and said that you're modeling your campaign after John McCain, that you're going to launch a furious comeback the way he did by fighting hard in New Hampshire and places like that, carrying your own bag at the airport. You know how many votes John McCain missed when he was... that furious comeback that you're now modeling it under?
He wasn't my...
No, Jeb, I don't remember... Senator. Well, let me tell you, I don't remember you ever complaining about John McCain's vote record. The only reason why you're doing it now is because we're running for the same position and someone has convinced you that attacking me is going to help you.
Well, I've been...
Here's the bottom line. I'm not... My campaign is going to be about the future of America. It's not going to be about attacking anyone else on this stage. I will continue to have tremendous admiration and respect for Governor Bush. I'm not running against Governor Bush. I'm not running against anyone on the stage. I'm running for president because there is no way we can elect Hillary Clinton to continue the policies of Barack
Obama. Thank you, Senator. I think there's a bigger issue.
Okay, and there you have it. Rubio basically, and that was literally the last thing. Maybe Jeb Bush, who was down at the bottom of the amount of time that he spoke after the debate, 90% of everything he said happened from that moment and earlier. And then I think he said basically good night, and that was the end. And that happened.
I think he gave
40
up.
I think he basically said to himself at that moment, "What the frick am I doing here? I'm done with this crap." And
I think he said to himself, "I'm rich. I and I'm not saying." You know, I'm playing the role of Jeb Bush for a second. I'm incredibly rich. I'm better than all these people.
Yep.
they're all trash compared to me. I'm a Bush, and I'm going to go back and live my yacht-like life. And that's my suspicion, is he will be out within a week or two.
Well, see, here's why I don't think he's out until after the next debate. It's because he's got to send that message to the American public. He is going to get up, I think. I think he's going to wait till the next debate, and he's going to say he's going to send his parting shot. He cannot go out like with a whimper. He has to go out and basically say to the American public, "You blew it because you are so bad, or you're so wrong, or you're so mixed up and confused. You don't get to have me as your president. I'm sorry, but that's just the way the cookie crumbles." And, you know, basically walks off the public stage at that point, having felt like he had walked away as opposed to basically been left out in the cold. So, and just today, it's reported in The Guardian that Sheldon Adelson, poised to make a multi-million dollar donation to the pro-Rubio Conservative Solutions Project allied super PAC. And so... and I think you're going to see a lot of former Romney supporters start to, they had been sitting on the sidelines. They had been taking their money off the table, waiting to see what was going to happen, waiting to see if Jeb could somehow, rise from the ashes. And frankly, look, I don't care what year it is or what shape the Republican Party is. This guy's a bad candidate. He's a bad candidate in any year. I mean, he would have lost in 2012 to Mitt Romney. He would have lost in 2008 to McCain. This guy's a bad candidate. And you know, even if you called him Jones instead of Bush, if the guy's last name was Jones, we wouldn't even be talking about him. He's no, that bad he's, of a team.
I mean, it's almost, I mean, it's more shocking and shows you the power of money and the family name back when it was a popular name in Republican politics, so the fact that he was able to win two terms in Florida.
Yep. Yep.
Because he's just, I never had seen him for this extended a period of time up in front of cameras and speaking, and he's just terrible. He's been terrible every time. And I just don't think he, I mean, it's not like he was, you know, one time he just said something that was a mistake and that cost him it, or one time he, you know, it's just his overall persona. It's grating, it's boring, you know, he's not likable in the slightest and has nothing really interesting to say, you know? I mean, what's his reason for running? He's running because he's a Bush. That's why
exactly.
He's running.
Exactly. And so we have Marco Rubio. So we're going to be left within a month, I think. Bush is going to be gone. Marco Rubio is going to be knighted the establishment candidate. However, my prediction is that as much as he has won that sort of like donor primary, I don't think he's going to get a bump, but he's not going to get that much of a bump in the polls. And I don't think it's going to be durable in any way. We'll see what happens on the 10th when people start going after him a little bit. But I think, you know.
And we know who will.
Well, I think it's going to be Trump, but I'm not sure about
it. It's going to be Trump, a combination, I think, of Trump and Cruz, and it's going to be on immigration, because that's where they can hit him on both a past vote, but you also get to imply he's one of them. So it's a double whammy to hit him on that.
And not only is he one of them, the thing that people don't realize is that Marco Rubio's favorability ratings in the Latino community is below where Mitt Romney's was. Because to the conservatives, they see Marco Rubio as the guy who's pushing immigration. To Latinos who have been paying attention to this fight in a way that I think not necessarily everybody has, that they know that this guy led them down the path. And when the going got rough, all he did is run. And he just dropped it like a hot potato so that he could run in this prime. Because, I mean, you know, here's a guy, here's where he hasn't been hit, Rubio. He comes out and he says, it's useless for me to be a senator. Okay, the votes are stupid. Well, this guy had the opportunity to lead a historic, historic reform in immigration. And he walked away from it with his tail between his legs. And at one point, someone's going to bring that up. Now, probably not in the Republican primary, but I don't think he's going to make it as the nominee. I really don't think he's going to make it as nominee. And his value is not. His value is not in the Latino community. His value is to white conservatives who want to convince themselves they're not racist.
That's exactly right. And a little bit of the Ben Carson vote in that. You know what I mean? I mean, I sort of separated last night. I mean, I like your framework, but I separated into a few different groups, you know. And to me, one of the sort of areas was the people that performed well, the people that were terrible and are going to have to drop out. You know, with Ben Carson, I don't know if you want to get to him yet.
Sure.
He was utterly terrible. But the thing is that he's in a position in the polls that he doesn't need to drop out, you know, and he wins this. He's realized he's had a whole second career on the right wing gravy train that Huckabee. So it wouldn't make sense for him. He'd stay in as long as he needs to anyhow. But I mean, you know, I don't know how these people are going to react, because I can't see what the hell they see in Carson anyhow, except for the, hey, look, I'm not racist. But I mean, he last night, literally, like it made his other performances seem downright energetic.
Well, we don't have the sound, but there was a moment where Carson is attempting to show that he can actually do policy. And the question, I can't remember if it was on Medicare, he looks down to his notes, he gets a couple of numbers in his head, he starts to talk about them. I think Hardwood, the moderator, asks him another question, and he's just flummoxed. Because he's not thinking he's actually going to have to use these numbers, you know, in relationship to each other. He just thinks that he could actually say the numbers, and that's enough to show his policy bona fides, which is not, I have to say, to be fair, which is not unreasonable when you're talking about a Republican debate, because these guys just do, that's what they do. There's no real policy there. It is just like, 15,000, John Hardwood, I said it. and that's it.
Yeah.
And that's basically it. But the funny part was, let's go to because I think he's going to drop a little bit. I think you're going to start to see Carson.
I do too.
His balloon is deflating a little bit. In fact, I saw an interview with him afterwards where somebody was saying, like, you didn't seem to have the greatest night, and he goes, you know, it's a small network,
and he starts snoring.
World Series.
Over.
He said, World Series are on. I don't think anybody watched it anyways.
I mean,
when you've got to say that, you know you got a problem. But here's where...
Watch him be the future pitch guy spokesperson for NyQuil PM.
Right, indeed. here is... I want you to listen to this, because here's Ted Cruz. And Ted Cruz got the biggest applause line of the night. He avoided a question. I can't even remember what it was. It's about the budget deal. This is fascinating, because I thought Ted Cruz would be, this is the guy who had basically been rallying the conservatives in the House to vote against Boehner, to vote against a budget deal like this. He didn't want to address it at all. He didn't want to address it at all because it was a failure and a loss on his part. And he was very successful in somehow getting through the night without anybody tagging him with that, because that was supposed to be his calling card, right? He was supposed to be the shadow majority leader in the House, and this guy's in the Senate. So instead of answering the question about the deal, what he does is he goes off on a rant against the media, and we're going to compare two rants against the media, and then we'll talk about it. Here's the first one. This is Ted Cruz at the debate last night ranting on the moderators, and if you notice, he also does a backhanded insult to every single other person on the stage in the guise of saying, I'm going to defend you, because he's bringing up insults that weren't even articulated at the debate. And frankly, stuck. Here we go.
Senator Cruz, congressional Republicans, Democrats, and the White House are about to strike a compromise that would raise the debt limit, prevent a government shutdown, and calm financial markets. That fear of another Washington-created crisis is on the way. Does your opposition to it show that you're not the kind of problem solver American voters want?
You know, let me say something at the outset. The questions that have been asked so far in this debate illustrate why the American people don't trust the media.
Pause it for 1 second. Okay, so he's just gotten an incredibly substantive question, which is, you know, what are your feelings about this deal? The tone of it was a little bit weird, because it was really more like, do you have a good personality for this stuff? But this is an opportunity for him to address it. And instead, he goes this way. Good.
This is not a cage match. And you look at the questions. Donald Trump, are you a comic book villain? Ben Carson, can you do math? John Kasich, will you insult two people over here? Marco Rubio, why don't you resign? Jeb Bush, why have your numbers fallen? How about talking about the substantive issues people care about? I'm not finished yet. The contrast with the Democratic debate, where every fawning question from the media was, which of you is more handsome and wise?
All right, so there it is. Now,
he is the perfect modern embodiment, down to the look and the voice, of McCarthy. It's amazing. The grievance politics, I mean, he says it. It's not that the other guys don't do it, but he says it more convincingly, to the point where I almost believe he believes his own crap.
Now, does that response remind you of another response that we heard in 2012 that ended up shooting this guy up into the polls? And that guy is Newt Gingrich. This is
when he attacked what's his name at Fox,
Chris
the
Wallace,
only non-white. No, wasn't it? Was it Chris Wallace?
Oh no, no, it was,
what's his name?
It was. I think it was Juan Gonzalez.
Juan Williams.
Was it Chris Wallace? All right, it was Chris Wallace. This is from 2011 in an Iowa debate in August of 2011. Let's hear Newt Gingrich's. And I'll tell you something. This is the thing that made Newt Gingrich a player in that race.
Thank you. Speaker Gingrich, one of the ways that we judge a candidate is the campaign they run. In June, almost your entire national campaign staff resigned, along with your staff here in Iowa. They said that you were undisciplined in campaigning and fundraising, and at last report, you're $1 million in debt. How do you respond to people who say that your campaign has been a mess so far?
Well, let me say, first of all, Chris, that I took seriously Brett's injunction to put aside the talking points. And I wish you would put aside the gotcha questions. Like Ronald Reagan, who had 13 senior staff resign the morning of the New Hampshire primary, and whose new campaign manager laid off 100 people because he had no money, because the consultants had spent it. Like John McCain, who had to go and run an inexpensive campaign because the consultants spent it. I intend to run on ideas. Congress should come back Monday. They should repeal the Dodd-Frank bill. They should repeal Sarbanes-Oxley. They should repeal Obamacare. They should institute Lean Six Sigma across the entire federal government, a hard idea for Washington reporters to cover, but an important idea because it's the key to American manufacturing success. I'd love to see the rest of tonight's debate asking us about what we would do to lead an America whose president has failed to lead instead of playing Mickey Mouse games.
So there you have it. And like, you know,
but don't you also hear Donald Trump in that?
Yes.
He may not always go directly after the media, although he does that sometimes.
And
too.
He did it last night.
Unfairly. Right. They're treating him unfairly, blah, blah, blah. But he picks on very popular, easy groups to sort of throw out conspiracies about and makes it into, you know, a big left-wing thing. Whatever group is criticizing him, whatever organization, again, this is that resentment politics that's all these guys can do, which is we're poor white guys and our lives have been tough.
You know what? I'll tell you something. This is exactly why I think Rubio is not going to be the nominee and why I think Ted Cruz is. Because people are saying that Marco Rubio, he showed that he was an everyman, that he could connect to the Republican people by talking about his dad and his mom, who was a cleaning lady, and his dad who was worked at a bartender or whatever it was. And that's not what connects with the Republican primary.
No, he'll never be an everyman to them because he's not like them.
Well, even despite the fact that Rubio and Cruz, right, they both have Latino last names. Cruz, he talks about this sense of being maligned and not being able to sort of express himself and how he's being unfairly picked upon. And that is what resonates with the everyman in the Republican Party.
That's a big part of it. I also would throw in Cruz. One of Cruz's parents is not Hispanic. He was born in Canada, his family's not from Cuba. Where they're originally from. Oh, no, they are from Cuba, aren't they? But he was born in Canada, and I think the connotation that's – I don't know. He he never supported initially as
right.
We talked about immigration.
He just hasn't associated himself with
He never associated himself with anything Hispanic in the way Rubio, who's, you know, from the Miami area, and the Cuban family story has been a big part of his story, whereas when Cruz tells his story, it's all about how his dad went from being a lefty to being a righty and how smart that was.
Right.
He's made it a big part of his identity, Rubio, and that's not what people who are not like him here, who are core Republicans, identify with. They identify much more with Cruz's story because there's a lot of them, you know, in rural areas, whites who were once FDR Democrats back when social issues didn't exist, back when you could leave, you know, African Americans out of Social Security because that's what you needed to do initially to get it passed. So you left farmers and domestic workers out of it because that's how you got it, Southern senators in the Democratic Party to support it. So you had this long line of, and it still happened in more recent years in places north of the Mason-Dixon line, in rural areas of places like Ohio, where you have people that as recently as 20 years ago, 15 years ago, were still calling themselves Democrats and now are Republicans. And so I think Cruz's story works much better, his sort of creation story, if you will, than Rubio's identifying with immigration and identifying with Cuba and and Miami and all of that. And I think you'll see a lot of that used against him. So I still, even whatever Adelson and Rubio's got a lot of talent as a speaker, but Cruz, even though he's not quite as talented a speaker, he's got their kind of charisma, as you were just saying. He has got the victimization thing down.
And he's got the Jesus juice. I mean, after Ben Carson drops out, I think you're going to see the fundamentalists start to rally around Ted Cruz. And now,
that's right. I mean, it's always the second, you know, I mean, whether it's about guns, he makes it so people are infringing on the rights of people like him, right? It, with guns. On gay marriage, remember how he made it about it's, you know, the religious victimization thing? You don't hear Rubio talking a lot about those things. Cruz is there for every one of those. Where, you know, people, poor people like Cruz who are just trying to live their life in a God-fearing and forward way are victimized. They have to accept, they have to make a cake for a gay couple, and they have to accept that these immigrants are coming in here illegally, and that women and what's going on in Planned Parenthood, women have these rights. And, you know, I mean, he plays that white male victimization perfectly. I've said it for a while now, and I thought Rubio was going to be the establishment choice. And I'm not bragging because I get a hell of a lot of stuff wrong, but this has played out similarly to how I thought it would, that Rubio would eventually, because he's the most talented of the people vying for that. But ultimately, I think that Cruz prevails. And, it, I mean, you know, it's frightening because I don't care who our nominee is. We better not lose that race or this country.
I mean, look, they're about to nominate somebody. It's either going to be, I don't think it's going to be Ben Carson. It's either going to be Donald Trump or Cruz or Rubio. And two of those three have said no exceptions for rape or incest when it comes to abortions. Good effing luck with that. And the third one's name is Donald Trump. Okay? So good luck with that. And it's going to be interesting. We got another debate coming up in November. It'll be interesting to see who's standing. It'll be interesting to see if... what happens if Lindsey Graham makes it onto the main stage? I don't know who is going to make it. Who of those four is going to poll anywhere enough to get on the main stage? But presumably,
well, Mitt Romney put in his pitch for him.
For
he
Graham,
wants Lindsey up there.
Mm-hmm.
Lindsey's Lindsey. I don't see what's going to happen. He's going to get up there. I mean, I suppose there's nobody who spends all their time on foreign policy who's up on that stage like him. Most of them are more based around domestic policy, and every once in a while, you know, Cruz and Rubio will yell out neocon things because they are thinking about Sheldon Adelson and that kind of money. But that's not what animates them in the way that it animates Lindsey Graham. So, you know, he'll add that element to the debate. So maybe it'll put him there just because of that. But obviously, he's going nowhere. He's, you know, well, it'll be the first time since, what, James Buchanan, if he were to win, that we would have what you would call a bachelor, quote-unquote, in the White House. Yeah.
Oh, no, Lindsey Graham, there, I think, is running for vice president, and I think he just wants to be the guy who could bring in some measure of foreign policy.
Actually, he's running for Secretary of Defense.
That's very possible as well, too. All right, let's pivot here, because there's two other things I want to talk about. We don't have too much time left. Let's talk about Bernie Sanders, just so that we can get a little bit of a compare and contrast thing. And then we'll talk about Paul Ryan and this debt deal. We're not going to have time to do it too deeply. But so Bernie Sanders is at George Mason University. And I want to play some audio of him calling for the decriminalization, essentially the decriminalization of marijuana. And I know that's an important issue in Ohio, too, actually, in the coming days. But before we get there, I want to play you a clip, which I thought was really moving. Now, it's a 4-minute clip. We're not going to play the whole thing. And maybe we'll put the whole thing up on YouTube. But for now, we're just going to play a couple of minutes of this. Because Bernie Sanders, let me just set the scene here. Bernie Sanders is speaking at George Mason University. He's taking questions from students in the audience. He gets a question. You can't see it on camera at first, but it's off to the left. And he starts to walk over towards there. And a woman gets up. She asks a question. She's wearing, is it a hijab? Is that what it is?
Hijab.
Hijab. And she is asking a question. She's a Muslim student. And then Bernie sort of like just in the mid question, just waves her over, like, come over here and ask that question. And you know, part of this is visual, but you can hear what Bernie Sanders is saying. He brings her up onto the podium and gives her a hug. Just listen to this. It's very moving. And it's really telling about, I think, you know, Bernie Sanders as a candidate, that this guy is, I think this moment is really going to mean something for young people in particular who don't harbor the same sort of like knee-jerk bigotry that we see across the spectrum. And but here's that clip of Bernie Sanders at George Mason University.
Okay, just be loud. I'll hear you. With the growing Islamophobia in this country, if you look at all the Republican candidates, in order to feed into their constituents, they're talking about Islamophobia and are constantly bashing Muslims in the media. Ben Carson, Donald Trump, the biggest bigots. As a Muslim student, as an American Muslim student who aspires to change this world.
So this is what Bernie is now signaling to bring her up.
As an American Muslim student who aspires to change the world, currently majoring in international conflict analysis and resolution major, and I hope to be a human rights attorney. Hearing the rhetoric that's going on in the media makes me sick, because I, as an individual, I'm constantly trying to raise awareness and make sure that everyone is treated equally in this country. So, President, to the next president of the United States, what do you think about that?
Here. Sanders hugs her again, brings her next to him on the podium.
This is what I think. This is what I think. Let me be very personal here, if I might. I'm Jewish. My father's family died in concentration camps. I will do everything that I can to rid this country of the ugly stain of racism, which has existed for far too many years.
Let me tell you something. Okay, and so it was an incredibly moving and impressive moment, I think, and
yeah,
one that I think is going to have a lot of resonance with young people and college students. And
I think so. It makes you really even go beyond the politics and like him as a person, because that's, you know, people, moments in history where people do important things like that. It's the imagery is important. You know what I mean? In situations like that. And when we're still in a point in time when somebody who's either leading or in second place polling in one of our major parties can say that we shouldn't have a Muslim as a president, or, you know, in the cabinet or anywhere. So for that hug, it means a lot more. You know what I mean? I mean, I don't want to sort of compare it in terms of fame, but I thought of when, you know, when Jackie Robinson first got into baseball in the major leagues, and none of his own players would even accept him. And Pee Wee Reese, you know, the shortstop on the Brooklyn Dodgers, who was from Kentucky, from Louisville, they have a statue there for him, went over and gave him a hug in front of the cameras on purpose. And that was a message to the end. He was very popular with the players, and that was a message that this guy's one of us. Mm. You know, imagery like that can be incredibly important.
Yeah, I mean, good for Bernie. I mean, it really is. It's a moving moment, because you can hear the frustration and the pain that young woman is going through, and it's at a time where there is increased. There is increased in this country Islamophobia, without a doubt. I mean, and you hear people try and intellectualize it, and you hear people, it's become like literally a cause for people to hate.
Yeah, a major news station and talkers to millions of people that legitimize it every day.
And not just on the right. I mean, we have to make it clear. It's not just on the right. It is so-called, so-called progressives who have an intellectual reason why they hate.
Right. On the left, it happens too, and there's no doubt about it. There's a couple big, you know, obviously the biggest of any of them is probably Bill Maher.
Mm.
And while I like a lot of what he does, I just think he's flat out wrong on that. And I don't think I wouldn't compare him to the Republicans in the manner in which he doesn't. It's hard. You have to get into the nuances of it.
Because
he doesn't sit there and say you as a person, but he doesn't attack the person, but he does overall say that the religion teaches this or that and the other thing. And frankly, that's because of where the culture of that religion and some of the desperation in the Middle East, it's the same desperation that leads people in poor areas to join gangs or do other things. I mean, you're going to go where, you know, if you're angry and you're disaffected, you're going to go and you're going to act that out.
And if we're talking about, sort of the tendencies that certain religions can breed, let's not remember that we just had a person who is alive talk about his father's family getting wiped out at a time. And if you do not think that there were, that the Holocaust played on Christian bigotry against different groups in Europe, are deluding yourself. Now, granted, that's 70 years ago, and that's a long time ago. But
you know what? I mean, it may not be as over, because we obviously do not have the government of a place like Saudi Arabia. You know, we have the kinds of principles that are more open-ended, but history isn't a straight line. You know, the 10th, 11th century, around those times, there were some very forward-looking cultures in parts of Europe, Cordoba, you know, in parts of the Middle East, where Muslims ruled and lived side by side with Jews and Christians.
Of course.
And we're in a period right now. I mean, look, we've had Christians killing each other in Ireland up until very recently. We had Christians killing each other when Yugoslavia fell apart. We're killing Muslims too, but killing each other in different places there over religious differences. We've got people who are gay and lesbian and transgender being killed here today in this country because of Christian bigotry. So, you know, it's in a worse spot right now, and in certainly a lot of parts of the Middle East and Far East or Southeast Asia, I should say, because of the kinds of governments that are ruling. But it's not to say that this stuff doesn't exist in all religions. And of course, I left out Israel and what a Bibi Netanyahu can do and the kinds of things he can say, and the Likud folks and even the ones further to the right who march in lockstep,
right,
and are ready to wipe out villages of people. So let's not pretend that it's a one religion thing.
Indeed. Or even just a religion thing, because I think we know
that's that a good point, too.
I mean, it's a human thing, sad to say.
It is.
And
sadly, there's a lot of a-holes out there,
right,
folks, and they'll find any excuse, whether it's religion or something else, to behave in the manner in which they want. A shame.
All right, let's turn to another thing that Bernie Sanders did. At George Mason University, Bernie Sanders made a call and has basically come out, and I believe he is out in front of every major candidate in any of the two parties at this point, and ones that have any shot at a nomination, in calling for essentially what amounts to the federal decriminalization of marijuana. Let's hear what he said at George Mason University.
In 2014, the latest statistics that I have seen, there were 620,000 arrests for marijuana possession. That is one arrest every minute. According to a report by the American Civil Liberties Union, there were more than 8 million marijuana arrests in the United States from 2001 to 2010, almost 9 in 10 of those arrests were for possession. Arrest for marijuana possession rose last year nationwide, even as Colorado, Washington, Oregon, Alaska, and the District of Columbia became the first states to legalize personal use of marijuana. And let us be clear, as is the case in many other areas, that there is a racial component to this situation. Although about the same proportion of blacks and whites use marijuana, a black person is almost 4 times more likely to be arrested for marijuana possession than a white person. Too many Americans have seen their lives destroyed because they have criminal records as a result of marijuana use. That is wrong. That has got to change.
Okay, and with that, he announced essentially that that he believes that marijuana should be removed from the list of schedule or basically most dangerous drugs that are outlawed by the federal government. As you know, there's like a schedule, and Martin O'Malley has called for putting marijuana on the Schedule 2, a less strict designation. But by removing it from this list, what Sanders is saying is that states are free to legalize or decriminalize marijuana. They are free to provide for medical marijuana use. And more important, maybe, well, maybe not necessarily more importantly, but equally as important, they are now allowing for sanctioned studies to happen with federal grants and basically allowing labs to do studies without fear of being raided and arrested for doing those studies, where marijuana can actually help people with a myriad of medical problems, and also to lead to the regulation of the production of marijuana byproducts that help people with things like epilepsy. We had Elizabeth Brunig on the program, I guess, about 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, to talk about that dilemma that parents who have found a drug that can actually help their kids, how hard it is for them to source it and to make sure they're getting what they think they should be getting.
Yeah, I mean, look, you're hitting on everything that right now, and there's a lot of things that go into this, but I'm going to try to sort of summarize it quickly in a couple minutes. I mean, you know, when you're talking about the war on drugs, and I mean, it's pretty clear what a failure that's been. I mean, you don't need to sit here. All you need is to look at research, look at studies, and look at science, and know specifically if you're talking about marijuana, that having that listed and treating that in the same manner as addictive, you know, drugs that kill people, you know, drugs like heroin and others that are epidemics, is just insanity. And so, you know, the number of those states moved forward that he mentioned, and I'm completely in support of what Bernie's doing. Here in Ohio, something that I've been probably, you know, I've been an evangelist for as much as I am on gun safety and things like that, you know, we're having a vote on Tuesday, and we don't even have medicinal in Ohio. This measure will give us both medicinal, and it will also allow personal use. And it's, you know, the usual suspects on the right came out against it. They put a poison pill amendment. We got all the signatures, you know, got it on the ballot, and then the legislature, led by the right wingers in there, put a poison pill amendment on there to try to trick people. So we're doing what we can to make sure everybody knows. But sadly, we've also had a group of people on the left who've opposed it and screamed and yelled about it and said, well, because they're limiting it to 10 farms here, that somehow that's a monopoly or something of that sort, which is ridiculous, because I just changed my phone company the other day for my cell phone, and I had like two choices. You know what I mean? Whereas right. This sets up 10 competing farms, and the thing is the people who have the funds are always going to be people. If it wasn't done this way, you'd have a bidding process, and guess who would get in? And you know, you need a lot of investment to start those farms. So the people are harping on that over the fact that this immediately stops us. You know, the ACLU is for this and pointed out how in 2012 we put 14,000 people in jail, hugely disproportionately African American, in the state of Ohio for possession of pot. It led to, you know, obviously a number of cases where we've had police shootings. They've stopped somebody because they smelled pot in their car. That would stop happening. We've got cases, you know, my wife went to high school with someone here, and her daughter, her name's Nicole Nazarene, her father were not bad the other day. Their daughter, as you pointed out, has a terrible case of epilepsy, sometimes 30 seizures a day. These other medicines literally maybe lower that by like two. Well, if, you know, when she uses medicinal marijuana, it lowers it to the point where she may have two seizures a day. And her dad has come out and said, you know, we don't have the resources to move from here like some people to Colorado. So it's one of two choices. You either legalize this or we're going to be criminals, because I will not deny my daughter what she needs. And I can give you more and more cases.
There and it's things, not just that. Know. He can't be sure what he's getting. You know, he can't
be sure. I mean, look, I'm going to what I think are, to me, the most compelling aspects of this. But of course, you don't know what you're getting. It used to be they'd mix PCP in there. You didn't know what was going on. The violence and black market that surrounds it. The fact that by legalizing this, we've already had, to go back to John Kasich, who got up and bragged about all he'd done economically the other night. Well, he was able to cut those taxes for those rich people because he starved all localities of our funds. He took them away from us. So to get those funds back for our police and fire departments, for the damn potholes in the road, right? Pot for potholes is one of the things people are calling it. This sets it up so that 85% of the funds will go to localities, the taxes on this. And that's another reason the state legislature is pissed, because they'd probably like to get their hands on that.
Right.
So, I mean, it's important that way. It creates thousands of jobs. I mean, I can go on and on with the benefits of this, but that we've taken this thing that originally was legalized out of racism. I mean, you can go back and listen to the old commercials from William Randolph Hearst talking about black men smoking pot and wanting white women. I mean, just all the ridiculousness you can imagine. And that we've kept this in the place where it is, and we've ruined so many lives, and it has so many detrimental effects on our society. So, you're never going to win over the right-wingers, but, I mean, anybody who's listening who knows people in Ohio, has relatives in Ohio, has friends here, or lives here, and votes here. I mean, we've been asking long before I got here, they've been asking the state legislature for medicinal since 1998, and it's never once gotten out of committee. The reason why these wealthy investors who are going to have these farms had to put up money for a campaign was because it cost millions. Ohio is the size of Alaska, Oregon, and Washington put together, three of the four other pot legalized states. So this is expensive. It's not quite New York, but it's a lot like that. You need money to run a campaign. And so is it perfect? No. Is this by far the answer? I mean, that anybody on the left would say, well, it's not perfect, so I'm going to, we're going to stop right. it from happening with all the people's lives that it helps. I just hope people understand. So really, my final message is, if you want to help people who need the medicinal, if you want to get people out of prison, if you want to have the tax money, and make sure people aren't being sold stuff that is dangerous for them, if you want to, help take down the black market and at least put a little bit more of a dent in the war on drugs, this is the way you do it. And what you have to do is you have to vote no on issue 2, which is the poison pill, and you have to vote yes on issue 3. So it's no on 2, yes on 3, and that's on Tuesday here. And then we'll have, the last thing I'll say is, we'll have out of that? We'll have by far the biggest state, the seventh biggest in the country, will have legalized, one in a much more conservative Midwest than the much more libertarian, liberal West. The presidential candidates coming in here will have to speak on this issue the way Bernie just did. The others will have to give their opinions, it'll be like gay marriage. Ohio could literally be a tipping point because you've got five other states that have it on the ballot in 16. Whereas if it goes down, it's a setback. So right. I implore people to look at the positives of this and vote no on 2 and yes on 3.
All right, let's just move on just briefly, because we're way over time, obviously, and everybody here is about to pass out. But
I know this is becoming like the Republican CNN debate.
I know, it's crazy. You should have pre-negotiated with me, like Donald Trump did. All right. So Paul Ryan's been elected Speaker of the House. Not a huge surprise over the past couple of days. There was a debt deal that went in passed the House last night. It passed with a vast majority of a Democratic support. The deal,
they only get like 89 Republicans or something.
89 Republicans. I think it was somewhere around 172 Democrats.
So they still can't even get together. Was it a third of their caucus? About? I mean, that's all. That's all they can get.
Right. That's it.
Good luck, Paul.
Yeah. Exactly. But with that said. They have averted the debt ceiling is basically the president has the authority to raise. And the president has always had the authority. But according to this, the president has the authority to raise the debt ceiling through March of 2017.
I wonder why that date? Why would they punt it to 17 and not 16?
Well, I mean, we know, because that's when President Clinton will
be
there.
That's what they want to be debating in October of
right, exactly.
of 16.
Now. Yeah. Now, there's a couple of things in this deal that, first off, it lifts the caps on the sequester so that both the military budget and the discretionary spending is raised. It was 266 to 167 was the final tally of the vote, but I think it was 172, yeah, something. We had those numbers more or less right.
Any Democrats vote against it? Do you know?
There were some. I think there were some, but I don't know how many.
I'm just wondering. Okay.
And it lifts the sequester. It increases discretionary spending and military spending by about $80 billion, split equally, supposedly. It makes changes to Medicare and Social Security Well, let's get to that in a second. To pay for this, they do auctioning off a spectrum controlled by the government. That's they sell crude oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, and they tighten tax rules for business partnerships. I mean, I don't know why there's a pay for this, right? I mean, it's not, but nevertheless, what it does is it limits a premium increase that was expected for Medicare Part B.
Right.
It funds Social Security disability insurance, which was going to be a big problem. We spoke to Harold Pollack about
this.
That's
a big deal because they had been, yeah, they'd been like Rand Paul under demagoguing that.
Yep. And so it that is funded, I believe, for 7 years. It also deals with a thing called file and suspend. And this is a little bit controversial, at least for people like you and I. Most of the Social Security wonk organizations say this file and suspend, where someone could file on one of their spouse or their divorced spouse or their if they were a widower or a widow, they could file on their partner's Social Security and suspend taking their own for a couple of years. Because if you take it later, like when you're 70, you get a higher payoff. Now, some people
right.
claim that only wealthy people do this, or people who are savvy about it, or that the numbers are not that high, et cetera, or that the program was never intended to be used in this way. I'm a little bit suspicious about that, but I'm also annoyed that Social Security is part of this budget deal because. It has nothing to do with the budget, but
I know, and it sets it in that way. You worry that it sets a precedent of sorts.
I also worry that it sets a precedent to negotiate on the debt ceiling period.
Right, which should just be something where, I mean, fine, we got it 2 years out of the way or a year and a half, but it should just be this is non-negotiable.
Right, and
debt you've already incurred. You're the people that are supposedly about being responsible. So either you're too dumb to understand what the debt ceiling is, which I would say is probably half to three quarters of them. And Ben Carson, or you just want to be a jerk like Ted Cruz and cause trouble and don't care what you bring down to forward your ambitions. But it's pretty simple. If you're talking about personal responsibility, that's if you have the money to pay off debt, you pay it off.
Now, Paul Ryan is not completely out of the woods now. I mean, supposedly this has paved the way for him to a certain extent, but you still got like the highway funding bill, I think, coming up in a couple of months. They punted that. I think you still have the XM, the Export-Import Bank, which I'm not terribly concerned about one way or
the other. And as sure as the sun comes up the next day, it will be March 2017 at some point.
Indeed.
If it doesn't end over those things, he may have bought himself a little bit of time, but do you think these guys aren't going to be that much angrier, and it's either going to be in the wake, and either way they are, because it's going to be in the wake of an electoral wipeout, and Republicans don't react to that the way the Democrats do. Democrats crawl in a hole and say, please don't hurt me, whereas the Republicans come out and are more convinced that they're right. So they want exact revenge. So there'll either be that reaction. Or there'll be the reaction of that they just won, and so that justifies their being able to do it anyhow. There's no scenario where I don't see them trying to shut the government down over this and not pay the debt ceiling.
All right. Well, we'll have more to say about Paul Ryan and about this deal. I imagine next week, Cliff, when we get a better sense. I mean, that's the really offensive thing about it. Apparently, it was longer than three pages, and we learned last night that the tax code should only be three pages long. And just coincidentally, according to Carly Fiorina, the tax form should also be three pages long. I think it was.
But Ted Cruz says it should be a postcard.
Right.
So. He beat her. Next, they're going to be like, it's have to keep getting smaller. The next person's like, it should be on the side. It should be on a stamp.
Now,
you know what I mean? It should be a molecule.
It would be, I'd be remiss if I did not mention that our own right-wing Mandela last night during the debate put out his proposal that the tax code and the tax form each individually should be only one letter. There should be only one letter involved in it at all. And I think... For the tax law, it would have been C for cut, apparently. So that's that. I just got to get there. Cliff has no idea what we're talking about.
No, not really, but I'm being polite.
So. All right. Well, you're doing a good job. Cliff, as always, a real pleasure. We will talk to you next week. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
All right. Talk to you later. Thanks for going along, buddy.
Bye.
Cliff Schechter, folks. All right. We're not going to go. Yeah. We were going to do a short show. We did an entire hour and a half practically of the show today. So, folks, no IMs, no calls. We're going to go because everybody's really fried. Just a reminder, you can support the show by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. And if 10 people join by Sunday or upgrade, Michael, hope you're satisfied.
Yes.
We will cut La Poupée, 4 members.
Please do it. For God's
sake.
4
members. We will cut it out. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. It's delicious coffee. You can get the majority blend. You know, Hanukkah, Eid, Christmas, not that far away. Kwanzaa. I mean, it's a good time to... New Year's, what a great thing. You're going to show up somebody's house. Oh, here's another bottle of champagne that you won't drink. And you'll see it a year from now, and it'll be like, ugh, what are we going to do with this huge bottle? Can we throw it out? No, that's not appropriate. Oh, or here's a great package of coffee, which you'll probably be done with by the time we get to February. And it's a 1-pound bag or a 5-pound bag of the Majority Report blend. What's the Majority Report? I'm glad you asked, et cetera, et cetera. That's right, I am. I'm very cosmopolitan. And yeah, it goes on like that. That's just a scenario. That's what you can anticipate, folks. And if you buy your crap from Amazon, by all means, buy it through our link. That's the least you can do, ladies and gentlemen, where you basically skim off of Jeff Bezos' profits and give it to the Majority Report. All right, folks, we will see you tomorrow on the program. I think we're anticipating maybe Ryan Grimm will give us
Another take
on this
on
week.
On the budget deal, maybe more on
Ryan
the
Grimm
deal.
From Huffington Post. All right, folks, we will see you tomorrow. Oh, wait a second. I should also say that we're posting, members should already have received the debate in full. We will post it for public people later. Bye-bye.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want. But I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. And my pilot light shining bright. I guess somewhere the choice was made for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot